Good morning, lovelies. It is a beautiful March afternoon, morning in Chicago, and we are sitting down here to record a podcast about conversation. This podcast, of course, will not be edited, and this is a prerequisite that I told Lizzie before we sat down today. And it just seems to me to be ironic if we had an edited episode about conversation, because that wouldn't be a full conversation in that case. So, yes, a conversation about conversation, very meta, very obscure. Let's go.
Hello, and welcome back to Diddy and Hawthorne in the In-Between. I'm your host, Mackenzie Gentz, and you're listening to my podcast about the relevancy of literature in the 21st century. Now bookmark that book, and let's begin.
Welcome, Lizzie. How are you today?
Hi. I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I have my coffee in front of me from Nameless Coffee Shop, and... Okay, so conversation about conversation. How does that start?
I really don't know.
Well, my idea when I was coming across this episode, I was actually walking back to the dorm, and I was like, what if we just got a bunch of meta concepts together in one conversation and tried to formulate them in a way that said something about the art of conversation itself? So something like, what makes a good conversation, or what makes a good conversationalist, and how do those things come together? Because I often feel like it's very stratified between something, a good conversation that covers a lot of ground that you get something out of, and then a conversation that's very dull and both participants aren't really wanting to participate. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So what say you? No? Are you opting out?
Why can't I think of anything to say?
Yeah, that's the problem. Like, is there gridlock when trying to have a conversation about conversation?
I think there's gridlock when trying to have conversation and being recorded.
I mean, that's definitely true. Lizzie, by the way, is the person that went on the David Sedaris excursion with me.
Ah, yes.
Yes. And we are not talking about David Sedaris today. Perhaps that will factor in somehow. But that was fun. We got to meet him. He gave us a bread roll.
Best bread roll I ever had.
Well, that was one of the things. Like, how do you start a conversation about conversation?
I don't know. Well, sorry.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, I moved the thing.
What's the first thing you think about when you start a conversation?
I guess it depends on the situation.
Well, say we fabricate a situation where it's you and someone that you are familiar with, so you'd like say hi to them or something when you pass by them, but you don't really know them. And you run into them at a coffee shop, what would be the first thing?
I'd probably say something like, how is your day going? I think the first thing I would think about is, what should I say to be a normal person?
Yeah.
In this situation.
Yeah, and then, yeah, so then you converse about your day, and at most points, the conversation would end presumably after some things, maybe some complaints were passed, like, oh, oral skills really sucks right now, or,
right,
you know, something, I'm stuck on a piece, or something like that.
You find common ground.
Yeah, exactly. But what differentiates that surface-level sort of conversation from a deeper conversation that you have perhaps with someone closer to you, or even a conversation that's really serious that you have with someone that you don't know? Is it duration?
Interesting. I feel like I've had some, like, small talk conversations that have lasted a very long time, which is uncomfortable, but, like, you can kind of keep it going for a while. So I don't know that it's duration. Maybe after you know someone for a while, you stop looking for the things that you have in common, and you start looking for
differences,
the ways that you're different, because that's, I don't know, how you like learn more about someone.
That makes sense. Yeah, definitely.
Maybe.
Yeah, I mean, and also, I think occasion is also really important. So
right.
We have these things called high tables at Willard, and I've had some really amazing conversations with the faculty fellows that partner with the residential college, but I've also had some pretty not so great conversations with them, and I think part of that was occasion, as in where the conversation is meeting each participant. So if I'm having a pretty busy or slogging day, then I'm not going to be as active a participant in conversation. And I might, like, I remember this one conversation, and this is embarrassing to admit because of the story, but I was talking with one of the lawyers for the university who's also a partner with our dorm, and I was telling him about how Noam Chomsky moved to my hometown in Arizona because he retired there and he's now a professor at U of A. So I was like, oh my goodness. I was like, yeah, but the heat won't fix Chomsky's creaky voice, because that's like a big joke in linguistics. But he didn't really take it as a joke, and it wasn't the right occasion, and yeah, so there were a lot of factors that day, and I wasn't having a particularly stress-free day by any means. So I think a lot of time occasion does matter, because if perhaps both of the participants in that situation were more relaxed, then the joke may have been more successful and less embarrassing.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah. What about dates?
What about dates?
What different kinds of conversation occur on dates? And how do you deem them successful or unsuccessful?
Like a first date?
Or any date, for that matter. Because I feel like dates are one of the most hyper-analyzed sources of conversation.
Yeah. I don't know. I mean, I think that kind of goes on what what I said earlier, like, once you get to know someone well enough, you start talking about the ways that you're different. And I don't know, I think that a date would probably just be like a very controlled environment, like, for conversation. Like, if you have a meal with someone, that's like, you're gonna sit down and have a conversation, and there's not anything else that you're also doing. Whereas, like, if you see an acquaintance in passing, you both might have somewhere to be, and then so you try to, like, say the right things to time it right so that you can go your separate ways at the end.
Yeah, very true.
Sorry.
Hey, I'm thinking about the date
should
that
have
I
brought
went
my
on.
Water.
Oh, do you want this one?
It's okay.
Yeah, I was thinking about the date that I went on recently, which was, I thought it went well, but the whole situation ended up being a total disaster and very embarrassing, I think, for everyone involved. But the conversation that we ended up having on the date was really phenomenal, and, like, the person that I went out with is really phenomenal as well. So I guess I was wondering, what kinds of conversations on dates indicate, I don't know, different states in the relationship? So the conversation that we had was very summative. So it was very like, I am this person and you are this person, or, you know, he was like, I am this person. But also we got into our likes and dislikes and our niches at school and the classes that we were taking and things like this. And so I think that we did end up going a lot on differences. Like, for example, I have a younger brother and he has, like, 3 older sisters. Mm-hmm. So there were a lot of, I think there was a lot of collaboration in that conversation, and it was a lot of it was both sides, going back and forth. And it wasn't a textbook, like, date or a textbook conversation by any means, but I do think that something was accomplished and it was meaningful. Like, we both know each other much better. And yeah, it was a date. So I was wondering, I guess, why did things end so badly? Was it the before the date or the after the date, or was it something in the conversation that broke it, I guess?
That's interesting.
Yeah, how to have a good date conversation.
I have an interesting story. Mm-hmm. I had to participate in a number of psychology, like, behavioral studies, and one of them, I got there and it was supposed to simulate a date, and so basically they made me, like, take a picture of myself and then fill out this, like, sort of dating profile, using air quotes, thing, and it was just like, what's your name? Now say some stuff about yourself. And I was like, okay. And there was another person there in a separate room doing the same thing. And so then, like, our things got exchanged and we had to fill out a survey. And then, like, we had a 5-minute conversation in person and then filled out a survey. And then a 5-minute conversation over, like, direct message from our two separate rooms and then filled out a survey. And it was really strange, but it did, like, it was interesting to see what the conversation was. Because, I mean, it was, like, 10 minutes total, so that's, yeah. Like, it's hard to get anything out of that. I really wonder, like, what they were even researching. but, yeah, I mean, I guess we started out talking about, like, classes and things like that, and then sort of got into just other random interests, and actually for the 5-minute segment at the beginning, it was, like, pretty awkward for the first 3 or 4 minutes, and then right at the end, you know, we started, like, getting in a real conversation. They were like, okay, you're done. I was like, oh, great.
Well, it's interesting that they have the electronic component as well.
Yeah, that was really interesting, because then on the, like, direct message thingy, it actually felt really strange, because I had just talked to this person, like, 30 seconds ago. But, like, over text, if someone uses a lot of exclamation points in all caps, then they seem really enthusiastic. And so, like, he was using a lot of exclamation points and stuff, but in person he was, like, really monotone. And it was sort of, I had this, like, cognitive dissonance, because I was reading these texts and I was like, oh, he's, like, so happy to be talking to me. And then I was like, wait, no, he was just, like, he feels normal. I saw him 30 seconds ago. And then, like, I walked back to my dorm with him because he lived nearby, and it was the same. He was just, like, totally normal, not that interested. And I was like, this is really interesting. So, and I guess there's not really anything weird about that. It just made me think about, like, how often is it that I'm having a text conversation with someone and we're both giving off, like,
signals that you don't need.
Yeah, signals that we, or, like, usually I think it is, like, a way more enthusiastic representation than we actually feel.
Well, and also, and trying to encapsulate things like facial expressions and gestures and intonation into one word, or, you know, like an emoji or something like that, is incredibly difficult. And I mean, kudos to, I guess, technology companies, because they are trying to make it more interactive, but at the same time that's a bit scarier, because really we have this notion of a second self now, an online self that we take care of and groom and give off days and, you know, dress up the way we do our physical selves. So that is to say that most people nowadays have online personas, and that kind of carries in. So every time they are reaching for their electronic devices, they have this persona that they become, I guess, or they perform in some way that's very different oftentimes than their actual self. But yeah, that reminds me of there's this movie called Personal Shopper that we watched a couple weeks ago, and Kristen Stewart, her texting style in that movie, really, oh my goodness.
Oh yeah.
And I was wondering how similar is her texting style in real life to the texting style in the movie, because she would put a space before the exclamation point or question mark. So it would be, or like, period, are you here, even. Space, question mark.
Oh, it was the question marks especially.
Yeah.
I'm remembering.
It was so odd. And I was like, does she even text? Does she even know?
Yeah. And I was thinking it would be really strange if she does that in real life, but it would be equally strange if they wrote it in the script. Like, this is the way you should be texting.
Well, maybe that's a French thing.
Oh.
Do we consider that?
Hmm.
Yeah, but then again, most of the movie was in English. So, the director makes his movies mostly in English as well. So.
That was not a good movie.
It was bad, but it was also so weird. And I think about it still after watching it, you know, 2 or 3 weeks ago.
Yeah. So yeah. Was it a bad movie?
Yeah. So yeah, was it a bad movie? That is to be desired. There is.
I don't think about it.
Yeah, there's something to be desired. I think about Kristen Stewart's acting, and I apologize for any Kristen Stewart fans out there, but
don't apologize.
Well, I don't want to offend people, but I also, like, my personal opinion is that Kristen Stewart, why did she win a French Oscar? I really don't understand. And I have nothing against Kay Stewart. I mean, oh, actually, the one thing I do have against Kay Stewart, now that we're on this topic, is that she, like, was cheating on Robert Pattinson, which I just think cheating is not cool. You should just tell them if you're not into them. You know,
mm-hmm.
Like, even if he proposed, then he's a good guy, presumably. Don't know. But yeah, anyway, but back to the topic at hand, which is conversation.
Okay.
What role does personality play into conversation?
Mm-hmm.
Because I feel like personality isn't as important as other factors.
Like situation or?
Not really situation, maybe common interest or.
Okay.
Yeah, or background or something on that level. Because if you put like opposites together, for example, a really exuberant person and then a really shy person together. Given enough time and given the right topic, they might have a meaningful conversation about something. And so I don't necessarily think that personalities will prevent people from, or shouldn't prevent people from having those kinds of conversations.
Mm-hmm. I don't know. I think often a really exuberant person, a really shy person can, like, pretty easily have a conversation.
Yeah.
I'm very introverted, and I've always had, like, these, like, extremely extroverted people becoming my friends, because I think I don't know, I think a lot of, like, extroverts are sort of drawn towards introverted energy if they want, like, a close friend, mm-hmm. you know,
mm-hmm.
yeah. And probably the other way around. Yeah, I would say I'm often drawn towards extroverts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, at some point, personality, I guess, is not as important as things like ideologies and socialization. So oftentimes people who have very different, like, religious or political beliefs, you know, the beliefs that make up the core of their being or their individual, I don't know, personas, oftentimes prevent people of, you know, disparate
mm-hmm.
ideologies from coming together and actually yeah. doing something meaningful, because they can't get past the fact that they're performing this identity and they don't want to be open to discourse about that identity, because, you know, that ensues yeah. existential crises
yeah.
oftentimes.
Yeah, and maybe that's why in like casual conversations, people often look for like to complain about the same things because you don't want your identities to be threatened, or you don't want to accidentally threaten the other person's identities.
Yeah, so it's like,
and when you don't know anything about the person, I guess you need to just keep it light and stay connected in some way.
So it's like a protective thing.
Yeah.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Yeah. Okay. I've been meaning to tell you about the situation anyway, so I'll just talk about it here. This is a good arena, I think. So, I have a mutual friend. Well, let's call him Mortimer. Mortimer is a like pretty nice. We know each other rather well, and so I would say that he is in a good position to like know me and see how I react and know how I would react in certain situations. So Mortimer knows everyone. Like, just, he knows a guy who knows everyone, okay? And there's this guy, Mortimer's roommate. We need another name. Dave. So
Mortimer and Dave.
To the end. So yeah, Mortimer, Dave is his roommate. So Dave and I apparently have very similar ideologies, which is unusual because I have pretty unique ideologies for a university student at my age. And this includes things like political and religious affiliations, which I'm not going to get into at this point. So Mortimer told me, he was like, you and Dave would be a really good couple. And I was like, what? Because I've met Dave and he's really nice and he has a lot of the same interests as me. I've maybe talked to him one time and we complained about oral skills, I'm pretty sure, together. But I really don't know him well enough to make that kind of a judgment. But Mortimer, on the other hand, knows both of us. So I was wondering, and also, I don't talk to this guy. Like, we mm-hmm. have lunch in the same group twice a week together, and I just have never talked to him. Yeah. So why is that block existent? And is it existent perhaps because of Mortimer's suggestion? Because he brought it up when both of us were there. Both Dave and I were there. He was like, you guys would make a really good couple. And I was like, what? Is that like a cop-out? Like, I refuse to participate here. Yeah, so I was wondering, why is there such a stalemate now? And why is that subject so taboo when in that situation? I mean, I guess I'm uncomfortable with the fact that I'm uncomfortable with it.
Yeah. That's meta too.
Yeah.
So, like, but before Mortimer had suggested this, it was like, you talked sometimes? Or no?
Yeah, I had seen Dave at the music school before. And we have had casual conversations. It's the same. It's literally the replication of the situation we hypothetically described earlier, where I would see mm-hmm. him, greet him,
complain about oral skills, yeah, and then leave.
Yeah, exactly. And maybe asking a few questions because I thought he was a guitar player, but apparently he plays a different instrument, which I'm not going to name because it's getting too close to him. So, yeah.
Interesting.
Yeah, no, Mortimer is very invested in this. I texted him and I was like, there's no way. because especially in the fact of the situation where he told both of us, why did he do this? That yeah. we would be good in a relationship. Dave was like, that came out of nowhere, and I was like, agree. And then the topic of the conversation immediately changed. Mm-hmm. And that's the other thing, is that humans as conversationalists are infinitely creative, which is another factor I think that we should discuss in some capacity.
Interesting. Maybe if Mortimer had brought it up later, after you had gotten to know Dave better,
yeah,
it wouldn't be so strange. But now...
Yeah, now it's just strange.
It's like you're caught between these two levels of having gotten to know someone. It's like Mortimer tried to jump you across a whole river, and you didn't quite make it, and you just fell in. So now you're just like never going to talk again because you fell in the river and probably died.
Well, and I mean, and the thing is that it's either going to be that situation or that now that he's implanted it somehow in Dave's mind, Dave is going to think it over more and more, subconsciously or consciously, and just things will just, I don't know, they'll melt like molasses and they'll settle. And something will happen. I feel something is brewing, but I'm not sure because Dave is known to be too nice to like tell people what he thinks. So, anywho, that's a weird situation that one conversation got everyone involved into. So I think if anything, that speaks to the power of conversation, especially on taboo subjects, like perhaps setting two people up or periods or things like this.
Right.
I had another topic that I forgot about.
You said that humans are infinitely creative.
They are. Well, and I mean, one of the keystones of human language is that we have a finite set of lexical items and semantic rules, so grammar, things like this, and we have an infinite amount of things to say. And that's particularly relevant for things like literature, which is what this podcast is about, ultimately, because there's no other species alive that can create the way that we do, and that's something I think to be celebrated, and there's nothing left to be desired after you realize the full extent and capacity of what humans can presumably do. But I was also gonna talk about Phonathon.
Okay.
I work for an organization called Phonathon here at Northwestern. Shout out. I love my job, so anything I say I hope will not be used against me. I don't have really anything bad to say about Phonathon, but it's an organization that calls alumni first and foremost for relational aspects, but second of all, of course, to ask for donations to the school. And the way that we speak to the alumni is highly monitored and highly theorized. So we have a lot of different trainings, and there are different calling pools of people. So for example, I was calling parents of students yesterday, so you vary your discourse.
I almost fell out of my chair, but it's fine.
You vary your discourse based on who you're calling, and a lot of times the conversation is highly mediated by who you think you're talking to. And as the job has gone on, as I've gotten more comfortable with it, I've definitely been more attuned to listening to people's intonations or things. And I can tell, immediately, probably within the first 10 seconds of the conversation, if they are going to be a candidate for donations or not. Just based on how they answer the phone, how they react to the way I introduce myself, the way they respond to silences, things like this. And it's so interesting because I really do think that conversation in that kind of context is somehow different from normal conversation. I'm wondering why that is. Yeah, because I'm calling strangers, but we have the common thread of going to school here.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think when you have conversations with such a specific goal, like I'm trying to get money out of this person, then...
Or trying to touch base with them.
Touch, right.
Yeah.
Sure.
Your disbelief is incredible.
Well, then, I don't know. Yeah, then the conversations are probably much more homogenous, and you can predict what's going to be said.
But at the same time, I do have such a varied pool of callers. So, like, I've talked to people who are currently retired, and they're talking about, I don't know, there's this one guy who's, like, a financial advisor somewhere. He was retired, of course, and he's talking about how his tax bracket got messed up somehow this year. And yada, yada, yada. So something as disparate as tax brackets to this woman who just graduated who started her own music school in this town. And so I think the discourse a lot of times is very varied. But something about that first few seconds is key to determining what the outcome of a conversation is. And that's not to say also that I haven't been surprised by people, because I definitely have. There are some people who are willing to give after the conversation who I was sure were suspicious or not willing to give at the beginning of the conversation. So that's just, and I guess what makes this interesting, particularly to me in this episode, is that I get paid to have conversations with people. And why is that the case? Yeah. What say you?
Well, I think your role is important there because of the people who weren't going to give it first but then end up surprising you, because that shows probably that it's like the conversation they had with you that convinced them. The question is the money that those people give more than the money you get paid for doing this job? Because if it's not, then Northwestern needs to rethink this program.
Well, one thing I will say about Vodafone programs in general is that they aren't the most lucrative. But I will say that the donations that come in are really substantial. And the pool of money, I guess this is important to talk about because of the way that people think about universities and endowments and such like this, is that the endowment, so Northwestern has an endowment of what? Can we Google it? Northwestern's endowment. It's some billion. I think it's 7 billion.
Oh my God.
Which is the GDP of several small countries.
Crazy.
Okay, yeah, the Northwestern's endowment is $11.01 billion. So, and we have 21,000 students, which is a lot. That's like half a billion per student, right? So.
That's insane.
Yes, so Northwestern doesn't have access to its endowment on an annual basis. So the endowment, that is a pool of funds that Northwestern has pulled together through things like investments and deals and contracts and things to create this, like, it's almost like the mattress that your, like, great aunt puts money into. Mm-hmm. Yeah, to create that, but, like, you can't touch that mattress. Like, the mattress is constantly on fire, so you just can't, like, approach it even. But then there's another pool of around $330 million, and that is the part that are things like donations and teachers' salaries, and that's the part that Phonathon controls. So the endowment is something that doesn't even cover the facilities costs of Northwestern, which is so crazy to think about because it seems like so much money, but in reality, that's just not how it works. The students aren't really directly impacted by that $11 billion. Especially not on a day-to-day basis. Whereas something like the annual fund is the rolling fund that's going to influence student activities and student life, professor salaries, research, scholarships, things like that, on a day-to-day basis. So that's the fund that we directly take out of, and that is directly influenced. So that $330 million is still a lot of money, but it doesn't cover the things that Northwestern has already promised and signed up for the next fiscal year. So yeah, that's...
So that's the budget crisis.
Yeah, that's the budget crisis. That's the reason why I have to call alumni for my job. And yeah, I think that's not to say, though, and I think that that's not the fault of Northwestern, and that's not the fault of major universities at all. Especially, there are a lot of complaints about places like Stanford and Harvard and, you know, the top 10 schools like Northwestern, that they are somehow at fault for creating these huge endowments and not really funding scholarships, but the methods and the institutions that are in place to prevent big scholarships from being issued are really what prevent the schools, not really the schools themselves. So I think, this is just my opinion, but I think that the schools really aren't to blame, because it will take a lot of time for things like scholarships to change.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, they are slowly but surely. Like Northwestern, for example, has an initiative to get 20% of the student population on Pell Grants by 2020, which is a number we've already made. So there is slowly come, there are people coming in on full scholarships. They are just, it's just going to take some time, I think.
Yeah.
Hmm. But yeah. Else the budget crisis. What are some triggers in conversation that, I don't know, that tell you mayday, or that tell you, wow, this is going really well?
Interesting.
I'm thinking about a big indication for me is if you lean towards each other when you're talking.
Is what?
Is an indication that things are going well.
Oh.
Because I've had, in particular, there's this, I have a friend in this youth group that I'm in, and we see each other once every 2 weeks or so. And every time we have a conversation, it's really great. It's a really great, fruitful conversation. But we always do that thing where we lean into each other, and like, you're very focused on the conversation, not necessarily other things that are happening.
Mm-hmm.
And if the conversation is interrupted, then you're suddenly very salient of the fact that you were leaning in, you know, to presumably to indicate focus or interest.
Yeah.
Yeah, whereas on my date, maybe, we weren't leaning in at all. I think it was kind of stark, and for obvious reasons after the fact, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Can you think of anything else?
Interesting. Well, I get really frustrated with people who stand too close.
Mm.
I think there are just some people who do that just, like, stand a little bit too close to you, and you have to keep taking a step back,
mm-hmm.
and another step back, and it's, like, that's weird. So that's, like, leaning in that it isn't reciprocated.
Mm-hmm.
Which is really strange.
Hmm.
Hmm.
Yeah, I think a mayday maybe would be if we're into a serious topic and they change the conversation to something mundane.
Yeah.
So, for example, the conversation that I mentioned Noam Chomsky in, I was talking about this research proposal that I have for Germany that has to do with historical linguistics, and talking about also how English used to have an informal you, the thou, Mm-hmm. So it's super interesting, the etymology of you.
Yeah.
But yeah, thou used to be the informal, and right. you is the formal. So we adopted you. We just eliminated thou over time. And he, I guess, got tired of me talking about linguistics, which he knew nothing about. So he was like, how are you adjusting to the weather from Arizona? Which is a conversation that I hate having because it's so irrelevant. But
yeah, I think every single high table I've been to where I talk to a faculty member, someone said, Howard, what do you think of the weather?
And why is the weather such a salient topic to talk about? I mean, it is something in common, but it's the least creative thing that we have in common, I think.
I know. Actually, this is sort of interesting. I have a friend who, like, talks about the weather, but, like, seriously talks about the weather.
Awesome.
Like, I see him at breakfast, like, 3 times a week. And when it was first getting cold, he would, like, every single time at breakfast, he would, like, give a full weather report to us. And we're like, okay, great. But so that's an example of, like, talking about the weather but actually being interested in the weather. Like, he had, like, 3 different apps that he was comparing. And it was...
Sounds like a lot.
Yeah. So that, it just struck me as really interesting. I think that's the only time I've heard someone talk about the weather consistently, but because they actually want to talk about the weather.
Yeah. No, I'm a radio host, 89.3 FM. Well, we're finding out so many little facts about me today and you. But I make it a point not to talk about the weather on my radio show. I'm like, this is just jazz, man. We're talking about jazz, not the weather, not the time.
Yeah.
89.3 FM, Tuesdays, 7:30, 8:30. That's my peg.
I mean, it's an easy thing to talk about because everyone experiences it, but at the same time, it's such a boring thing to talk about because everyone experiences it, so we just don't need to.
Yeah, exactly. And there's no variation. So it's not like we both know what the color green is, but what is your conception of this green versus my conception of this green?
Yeah, or like another common topic of conversation is like if it's Tuesday, but someone thinks it feels like a Monday, and you're like, oh, I think it feels like Monday too. Like,
and that conversation ends there.
Right, unless more people chime in, which kind of happens to me very often.
Yeah, that's true. But the conception weather, of time.
Yeah.
How does that vary in conversation? Do you ever have conversations that feel so short, but you've been there for so long? Or do people generally have good conceptions of how long a conversation lasts?
That's an interesting question.
I think people generally, in my experience, or at least I can't speak for anyone else because I've never been in anyone else's head, but for me, I usually have a good conception of how long a conversation lasts, but I don't necessarily think about how long it's lasting until after it's over, if it's a good conversation. If
right.
it's a bad conversation, then I'm, like, cognizant of every second that I'm spending wasting my time on the conversation.
Yeah, me too. And sometimes it doesn't even have to be if it's a bad conversation. It's just if I'm tired or if I'm going to have to be somewhere pretty soon. Yeah, but there have definitely been times where I've, like, sat in the dining hall for, like, 2 hours talking to someone and didn't realize until afterwards.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and there are certain people that you know talk a lot to you. Like, my youth orchestra director back home, she just isn't capable of having a short conversation, which is wonderful. She's a wonderful lady. But every time she calls, I know I'm going to be on the phone for a while.
Yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. I think humor is an interesting function in conversation.
Mm-hmm. Say more.
I think it's an easy way to get out of an uncomfortable moment.
Oh, okay.
I feel like that's a big thing people use it for.
Yeah.
Like if someone says something and you find it, like, uncomfortable or just, like, not something you want to talk about right then, I mean, my first reaction is usually to, like, make a joke or, like, laugh it off.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. I immediately thought to a linguistics principle called the cooperative principle, which is something we've been skirting around the definition of for this whole conversation. But it's essentially that we assume as speakers and hearers that the other person in the conversation is going to be cooperative with you.
Right.
And that they're going to generally tell the truth. They're going to generally do things like say things that are relevant to the conversation, say enough and not too much information, and so on and so forth. And the manner in which they say these things will be appropriate and orderly and things like that. So yeah, it's just interesting because humor and things like sarcasm, lying and misleading and bullshitting are all things that break the cooperative principle, but I don't think that we would have effective or useful or engaging conversations without those things.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think, yeah, sarcasm could even be more cooperative than not using sarcasm in some cases.
Well, sarcasm, linguistically at least, breaks the quality maxim. Wait, we have talked a bit about this before, haven't we?
I think.
Yeah. So yeah, there are the four Grice's maxims. I won't get into them. But the quality, that you don't say something that you believe to be false, and that you don't say something that which you lack adequate evidence for. So sarcasm, something like, great friend you are, that's you're saying something that you don't believe to be true if you're saying it sarcastically. So I don't believe you're a great friend, but I'm saying great friend you are with a different intonation. So that breaks the quality maxim. That's an uncooperative. I mean, I guess supposedly you are still cooperative, but it breaks one of the maxims.
Yeah. I feel like with sarcasm, though, it's assumed that both people know.
Yeah, and that's another thing is that if you're misleading or lying effectively, then the hearer shouldn't know that you're misleading or lying.
Right.
But in order to do things like sarcasm and humor appropriately, the hearer has to know. So are you, it's called flouting a maxim in linguistics. If you flout a maxim and the hearer doesn't pick up on that, are you still flouting? And I think that, I think that the hearer ultimately is the one that decides.
If the hearer doesn't pick up on sarcasm?
Right.
Okay.
Then they're going to take your belief. So if I say, great friend you are, sarcastically, but you don't hear it as sarcastically, you're going to believe that I'm saying that she is a great friend.
Right.
Yeah, whereas I meant something different. So to them, that comes out as a lie, if they know for a fact that I don't think it's a great, that that person is a great friend.
Interesting.
So I think ultimately the speaker has a responsibility for clarity, but the hearer has a lot of the agency in the conversation.
But what if it goes the other way? What if you say something genuinely, but the hearer interprets it as sarcasm? Because we use sarcasm so much just in daily life.
Yeah, I think same thing. I think that if I say, great friend, you are genuinely, and they think, oh, they don't actually think I'm a great friend, then that is on you to make sure that it's more clear and less, I don't know, less interpretive. But yeah, but also my opinion is not the blanket answer. So, and the context and situations, as we mentioned before, are infinite. And that's what's so cool and so interesting about things like conversation.
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is the pragmatics realm of linguistics, which is my chosen field. So, yeah, and you can put this all into, like, a tidy, neat mathematical equation and try to determine things like truth value, and it's nice. Really cool.
Yay. Wow.
Wow. Math.
Wait, how do you decide when a conversation is over?
Oh, that is very true. I think, oh, yeah, like, there are some podcasts I listen to, and they just end the conversation. I'm like, where did that ending come from?
I agree with that.
Yeah, I think sometimes
they hit an hour, and they're like, eh.
I'm like, wait a second, talk about Gucci more. Just kidding. Yeah. I mean, I think that when you just feel exhausted in a good conversation, or terms of, I do a lot of podcasts, so we usually record for longer than necessary and get more information than necessary, as you all know by the episodes I published, especially the outtakes episodes, which are always fun. But yeah, I think that you just are collectively exhausted.
Yeah. I think sometimes if I'm not totally invested in a conversation, or if I have to be somewhere, then I'll start looking for gaps where I can say, okay, gotta go. And sometimes I'll miss my chance and the person will start talking about something for like 5 minutes.
Yes. Oh, my goodness.
And then there's just nothing I can do.
Mm-hmm. Or if you're in that rigid body position, like stressed, I need to go, for too long, then the other person will think that you're just inattentive to them, and then they'll just think that you're rude or something.
Or if you start to like if I'm in the dining hall, if I start to like stack up my silverware on my plate, or like, I don't know, start to put on my coat, then that sort of gives a signal. Mm-hmm. I guess that would be a sociological perspective.
Wow.
To answer your question finally.
Yes. That's very true. I want to talk about your Barnes & Noble excursion.
Oh. That really wasn't very interesting.
Really?
No. Because it's Barnes & Noble, everyone's quiet.
Yeah. But you observed so much about the movements of people.
Not really.
Really?
I, like, didn't find anything substantial. I mean, actually, this was kind of interesting. Well, it wasn't really that interesting. The only people I heard asking for help from the employees were females. I didn't hear any men asking for help.
Interesting.
But I didn't hear that many people ask for help either.
I always ask for help,
so it wasn't that big of a sample size.
Okay. Yeah, you said something about the escalators earlier as well.
Oh, people always stand on the escalators. Usually they don't walk.
Huh.
And at other places, you know, if you go to like the metro station in DC, everybody's like running up and down the escalators. Yeah, but for the most part, it was very low-key.
Yeah. Oh, and for background, for people who don't know what we're talking about, Lizzie went to Barnes & Noble for a long time, like a few hours, right?
Like 4 hours total, I think.
Yeah, and observed a Barnes & Noble.
I had to do that for a class. I'm not creepy.
yeah.
It was like a sociological observation project.
Yeah.
Wow. Yeah.
What a good time.
And then, this is the funny thing, actually. Two of my friends took the same class that I did this quarter.
Oh.
And they also did their observation project of Barnes & Noble. And I was talking to my friend, and she said, we observed so much. It was crazy. Look at all my notes. And I was like, are you kidding me? I didn't notice anything. I just felt like there wasn't much of use to say. Or everything I observed, you know, it would be like one person does this thing, and then I wouldn't see anyone else do that same thing. So it was like, how can I say that this is statistically relevant?
Yeah, and where would you sit? Did you sit
I walked around.
Oh.
The cafe was full.
4 hours.
Yeah.
That sounds terrifying.
Or I sat down for a little bit. It wasn't 4 hours straight.
Oh, okay. You went in installments.
It was like three different occasions.
Okay. Yeah, that's interesting. We should go to Barnes & Noble soon.
Yeah.
Awesome. Well, do you have anything else about conversation to say?
I don't think I do.
Well, that was, I think, a productive conversation about conversation.
It was.
Yes, indeed. I hope you all enjoyed. Our next episode is going to be, I believe it'll be either the New York Times episode or an episode all about form. So what is a short story? What is a novel? And I will update. I will edit this part and recheck on that so that I can figure that out. But yeah, thank you so much, Lizzie, for coming in and talking about conversation.
Thank you for having me.
Lovely.
If you enjoyed the discussion and would like to hear more from me, there is an episode of DH&I for everyone, so I'd recommend checking out our back catalog of episodes. 2019 is the year of Didion, so if you'd like to follow along in my quest to read Joan Didion's collective works or learn more about the movement to bring lit back to people, everything can be found at didionandhawthorne.blueberry.net, and remember that blueberry is spelled B-L-U-B-R-R-Y. Now you can also follow the show on Twitter with @DidionIn, 2 N's total. I'll be posting about new lit releases, reading lists, and of course the new projects and episodes relating to DH&I.